2 weeks already giving shiurim to all the various women's seminaries that have a joint program with Torah College when it comes to our women's college in Manhattan. Can I hurry? We have almost 400 women in that college alone. And in my early years, I used to be the Mashgiach Chuchni in Stern College. So I've dealt with all most of us. I'm a Muslim from RU, as Avishai is, as Rabbi David is. And I've watched his career, Kanai Nahara, develop over the years. And I want you to know you're very lucky to have him as your Rebbe. His city, Beit Shemesh, is lucky to have him as a Rav. And Klaus is lucky to have him as one of the Rabbanim who are leading this generation. I just hope that what he wants to be Mashpia when it comes to your development and the development of Klal Yisrael should be Makuyim, because if that's Makuyim, there'll be a lot of Shalom in this world, that's for sure. The topic today is very dear to my heart, and forgive me for the pun, as you'll see very shortly. The reason I'm saying that is because, as Rabbi David mentioned, besides all my activities of being Mechanech and doing Chinuch, one of the subcategories in halacha that I really got into very much many, many years ago was the concept of medicine, halacha, medical ethics. In fact, in the time of YU, when I was really still very involved in the men's division, giving shurim in the college, at that time there was a major debate about whether brain death should be accepted in halacha. Historically, most of the Rosh Hashivas did not want to touch the debate. But I ended up being the one that was chosen to debate Rabbi Tendler on the topic twice. The first debate was a five-hour debate up in the mountains. About 600 people came. And that was some debate. They called it the Great Debate. The Great Debate was the fact both of us were still physically standing by the time the debate was over. And then Rabbi Tendler had so much fun, we decided to do it a second time around in Borough Park. In Borough Park, when we did it, it seems he had a strong following over there. Therefore, they put up barricades around the shul with crowd control so we wouldn't have any major rioting taking place. And at that time, I remember a bus came down from YU with his talmidim, a bus came down from Stern with my talmidim, and it was a very interesting match. And Baruch Hashem, we did it a second time. The decision was we're not going to do it a third time. But I did do it a third time, but not in an actual debate. But there's a document over here I'm going to be leaving with Rabbi David, which is a 110-page article that I, as part of member of the Vad Halacha of the RCA, together with about six other of my chaverim, put together as the most comprehensive analysis of brain death and halacha that ever existed. It's more than a shita mekubetzes. I call it a minchas chinuch on the topic, because what we had to do is we analyze every shitas, harishon, all the balei tesvos, the rishonim and achronim, and as we come into our generation, almost every gadol who was involved in this topic, even the members of the Rabbanus HaRoshes, were interviewed when it comes to developing this document. This is an historical document. After you hear part of the shiur today, you might have an interest, and I would suggest that you keep the hard copy for yourself. It's going to become a part of halacha literature, I can guarantee you, and make a couple of copies for the chevra so they can use it to go through the makot. You'll find it fascinating. Especially when it comes to the development of this halacha, the fascinating phenomenon of how halacha is developed and how certain gedolim rely upon other gedolim to come to the decisions, which we'll see later on whether or not halachically it's appropriate or not. How halacha develops and the dimensions and the dramatics behind it and the interface between science and medicine. This document is fascinating. I read it over the last couple of days myself just to refresh my own memory and what we wrote over here. And you will see that you'll be reading part of history. So I'm leaving this as a matana to you, but I'll let the chevra have some copies of it because I think they'll really benefit from it. Now with that in mind, I want to get into the topic, but I'm not going to start with brain death because even though it's probably one of the most lively topics in halacha, and I really mean this, and that's not a pun either, it's the truth. For some reason it brings out everybody's blood and everybody starts pumping over here and everybody starts pontificating. But I'm going to start with a couple of days before a person dies, and that is how you treat a person who's terminally ill, the major halachic problems concerning euthanasia. And I'm talking now not as a theorist. I'm actually a practicing medical ethicist in the field. I sit on medical ethical boards in hospitals. And I have to fight with secular medical ethicists when it comes to trying to keep Jewish patients alive. And what I want to mention this morning as an entree into this topic, are three major yesodos that I personally feel show the difference between the way we conduct ourselves concerning a person who's terminally ill, in contradistinction to the way the secular world does. Listen very carefully, because you'll learn some phenomenal things this morning that you might not have ever dealt with before. The first part of the first yesod that I want to mention this morning is a very famous expression that you find throughout the press today, and that is the concept of quality of life. If anybody has ever read any articles concerning end of life, one of the major reasons medical ethical commissions want to put people out of business and put them into the ground is, what quality of life do these people have? They're connected to every type of machine you possibly can think of. They have all different types of nasal gas and tubing going in and outside of their body. They're living on medicine. They're living on all different types of artificial mechanisms. Why in the world do you want to keep this person alive? Where's their quality of life? And therefore, what's the alternative? Euthanasia. We'll put the person out of their misery. In some places in this world, they use what is called active medical euthanasia, in which they basically use poisonous drugs, suicide machines. There was a doctor who specialized in murder. His name was Kevorkian. And Kevorkian was so successful in murder that the United States felt he's a sakana to the American public. They put him in prison for a little while to keep him out of business. But when he started putting some of the inmates out of business, they decided, no matter where he is, he's a dangerous person. So he himself was renowned for being the expert in mercy killing. Euthanasia means, to use good old Webster Dictionary's definition, he says it is a painless and happy death that is recommended by individuals who want to put people out of their misery because they're suffering from terminal illness. I always used to wonder, when Webster said this, how many people he interviewed after they were killed for euthanasia to find out how happy and painless it was. But by the fact he says that type of expression implies to me he has a certain hashkafa, which meant to say he was an advocate for it, and that's why he basically postured it in such a positive vein. Quality of life. What about quality of life? So there's a famous Gemara in Yoma, which you have in your package over here, which is contained on page number 7, where the Mishnah deals with the concept in the Masechtas Yoma of Nebuch, a person who was on Shabbos in their house. Earthquake takes place. The building collapses upon them. Hatzalah comes to the scene, and Hatzalah now has to make a decision. This person, how wounded are they? And they made a calculation that the person's cranium is so crushed and the body is so mangled, this person only has momentary life yet. It's called Chaye Shah. So the Shayla that they asked is, are we allowed, or perhaps are we mechuyev on Shabbos, the Mechalel Shabbos, for Pekuach Nefesh, violating Melechos Deraisa, to excreate this person, because if we take him out of the pile and the rubble, we take away the trauma, he might live a couple of more minutes. Are we allowed, or perhaps are we mechuyev to Mechalel Shabbos for this type of Pekuach Nefesh of Chaye Shah? The Gemara Paskins in quotation 7a, Dafilu Chaye Shah, that Halach Lamasa, even for Chaye Shah, you're mechuyev to take the person out of that rubble. You'll look it up later on in Simon Shin Chav Tes and Aruch Chaim. You'll find exactly where the Shulchan Aruch quotes this verbatim. And therefore, no matter how wounded they are, if there's any minimal life yet, you're mechuyev and atari to take this person out. Based upon the pasuk v'chay behem v'lo shiyamus behem, as the Mishnah Berurah himself points out, that does not require a person to stay alive for another Shabbos to be Meshabbos Shabbos is harbe. It's based upon the pasuk v'chay behem v'lo shiyamus behem, which means, as far as we're concerned, every minute of human life is of infinite value. And that's hashkafically the essence of what the Torah is all about. Every minute of human life is of infinite value. The Mir Yufak says in Masechtas Yoma that we sometimes make a mistake and think when a person's comatose, they're not cognizant of anything and they're totally out of it. We know now that's not true. And we know this because some comatose people came out of the coma and told us how they knew all the discussions taking place in the room at their bedside, which we hoped they would never hear. And a lot of kids fight about the Yerusha in front of the comatose patient, not realizing they hear every word. And later on, when they came out of the coma, they told them, I heard what you said, you know. So Chazal tell us, thousands of years ago, we know that people sometimes that are comatose do have recognition, but they can't communicate. The Miri says this person might have 5 more minutes to live, and if you give him those 5 extra minutes, he might be Mahara B'tshuva. He might be able to do something to cause tikkun for himself. He won't have any problem later on. So for this reason, Chazal were magdish the value of life, and therefore l'chayesh ha'chashinin yomuchiv thereafter mafakeach b'kuach nefesh. Therefore by us, it's not quality of life, it's quantity of life, and therefore that makes all the world of the difference between us and the non-Jewish world. I want to mention there's a Mishnah Masechta Sanhedrin you also have on page number 1 called Mekayim Nefesh Achas Kilo Mekayim Kiyem Oyla Malay. A person is Mekayim, one human being, as if you basically cause an entire world to come into existence. The infinite value of even one human life on a geometrical progression, how many thousands of people sometimes emanate from one human being. Therefore the destruction that time of Hevel was so catastrophic, because who knows how many thousands of people would have emanated from him if Cain would not have killed him. So therefore, we therefore see that when it comes to the yisod of quality of life, that is not above a cheshbon when it comes to the way we deal with the patient. That's number one. Number two, the second major concept which you have in the secular world of medical ethics is the concept of patient autonomy. You heard the battle cry before? People usually who want to explain, well, they have a right to tell the doctor, pull the plug upon me.
Patient's rights.
Yeah, patient's rights. Or a woman wants to undergo a non-therapeutic abortion. It's my body, it's my baby, I can do what I want with it. Patient autonomy. I have autonomy over my body. I can decide, I'm going to die, I'm going to live, the baby's going to die, the baby's going to live. A tremendous battle cry on the left hand, which they use continuously over and over again to justify all types of euthanasia and other types of mercy killing. When it comes to Hashkafas HaTorah, what do we believe when it comes to this? So in the first page of Yemar HaMakomis, if you look at quotation number 8, there's a Rambam. A Rambam from Hilchos Ratzeach, where the Rambam says very simply, "Ein Adam Kinyano Elo Kinyan Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu." A person doesn't belong to himself, a person belongs to the Rabbanu Shalom. And it's very interesting and fascinating. Hashem puts us in this world for a specific mission. Each and every one of us has a tachlis in this world. There's a tafka that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us to do in this world, and during our lifetime we have to use our guf and neshama to do that type of tachlis, to become that specific tafka. Despite the fact that's the case, the guf Hashem gave us, and the neshama Hashem gave us, belongs really to the Rabbanu Shalom. It's given to us on loan to use it constructively. So halachically, we're really shomerim on our body and our soul. There's a pasuk in the Torah which you have in the Bar Mekomas, quotation number E, Nishmartem Oid L'Nafsho Seichem, which the Rambam and other Rishonim use as the makar of being asur to put yourself in a makom shel sakana. You can't put yourself in a place of endangerment. You can't endanger your body by doing stupid things. You can't endanger your soul by putting themselves in hashkafically a makom sakanas nefashais. When mechuyev to do a shmira, ma'alya, on our body and soul, that's our mandate. The Gemara says in Baba Kama Daf Tzedek, I can't even take my head and knock it against the wall to cause myself to bleed, because the body doesn't belong to me. And if I did that, I'm chayev being chovel biatzmi. And surely I can't tell a doctor to kill me or to hurt me and make a wound. That's not medically justified. There's the iser of Chabalah. Minus sinus reshus is l'maylo morid and adam kinyano elokin HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In fact, the Radvaz quotes another pasuk from Yecheskel, Lamed Zayin, ha'nefashos lihena. The nefashos Hashem belong to me. So if that's the case, we don't have any bialis. If we have no bialis, we sure don't have patient autonomy to determine whether we're going to live or die. After all, life is something involuntary. Life was never given to us because we wanted it. It's being taken away. It's in the hands of the Rabbanu Shalom. And therefore, technically speaking, we negate without a question the concept of patient autonomy. Which now brings me to Yisod number 3. When it comes to the Issa of Ritzicha, Rabbi Isai, one of the 3 classical cases that the Torah gives, not only heter, perhaps a mitzvah, to perform Ritzicha. The 3 famous cases. The Melech, which is representative of Melchemes Mitzvah. So in which any time you have Melchemes Mitzvah, whether it's Mechiyas HaMelech, whether it's the concept of Hachret Tachrimim, of the Zayin Amimim, or even a war of self-defense, like we have in Eretz Yisrael the last 70 years, Ezra's Yom Yatzar, these are all Melchemes Mitzvahs, you're allowed to kill the people that you're supposed to be killing in this war, either for self-defense or because of the Tzivi HaRabbanu Shalom. So Melchemes Mitzvah is one category, yes? What? The Nid of Rodef. Personal pursuit. Habol HaGecha HaShki V'Hagav, the Gemara Masech the Sanhedrin. That unquestionably is a mitzvah to kill a person before they kill you. No question that had to Ritzicha. What's the 3rd example? Mises Bezdin. A person's high because of Chilu Shabbos De'Raisa. Edom, Hasra, the whole shmir or across the board, whether it's that capital offense, Avodah Zarah, Gilurais, whatever it might be, the Bez is mitzvah to administer Mises Bezdin, and the Mises Bezdin is not only a question of an oynish, but it's also a kapara. That gives the person a kapara. That's why we tell the person to be mizvada before they are killed, so that should be part of the kapara process. These are three cases with unquestionable permit for us to take human life. The reason I'm saying this is because in the non-Jewish world, they're always very, very, you know, hesitant about capital punishment. It's only putting patients out of misery. They have no problem with killing them. But taking seasoned murderers in the jail and putting them in some type of situation to practice capital punishment, there's a certain hypocrisy in our society. But halacha l'masa, these three cases are permitted by halacha. Let me ask you the following question. If a person in their machshava, and they're going to perform a ma'aser shel ritzicha, has a kavana ritzuya, they're doing it not because of animosity and hatred, but they're doing it because of love and compassion. I can't stand to see my mishpacha member with all the gadgetry surrounding them in that ICU unit. I can't stand it. They're in pain. They're in anguish. I want to put him out of his misery. Practice euthanasia. Does kavanas haritzicha make a difference in the halachic value of isur ritzicha? So the gadol who deals with this topic very early on in the Chumash is the Ksav HaKabbalah Rav Mecklenburg. And in the Pasuk and Pashas Noach, if you have it in your mind, Mekamas Rabbi Yisai, turn quickly to page number 6. On the left-hand side, the bottom of the page, quotation number F. When the Rabban Hashem had Noach and his children come out of the tape after the Mabel, it's interesting, of all the Zionists of B'nai Noach, the only mitzvah that Hashem initially discussed with them was the Isur Ritzicha. It's interesting, the seven mitzvahs, but that's the one he concentrated upon. And in quotation number F, you have the pasuk, Achazdim chlanav shasechem edrash, miyad kachaya edrashana, miyad adam, miyad ish achiv edrash, es nefesh adam. The Torah tells us that I'm going to hold accountable not only people who killed homicide, but people who killed fratricide, killing your brother. So the obvious question of Mecklenburg and others asked, once the Rebbeinu Hashem posited the Isur of homicide, why in the world did Hashem see the need to have to mention as well that fratricide, killing your brothers, it's ritzicha across the board? To which Rav Mecklenburg is mechadish that the Torah in the Rabban Hashem's phraseology is explaining two different types of murder. When you kill strangers, you usually do it because of animosity. You want to put them out of this world. You hate them. You want to take their possessions. So that's why homicide normally is practiced. Amongst brothers, that's not normal, even though it could happen. Normally, brothers want to put each other out of this world, not because they're fighting over the Yerusha necessarily, but because they see they're in pain and anguish, and I can't stand up to that person in that type of anguish. So you're doing it because of the Rachmanut. What he basically says is the Rabban Hashem says to B'nai Noach, I don't care what your machshava is for doing the Ritzicha, whether it's because of Achzarias or Sinah, or whether it's because of Ava and Rachmanis, Ritzicha, shvichas dam, and it is prohibited. From here, Rav Mecklenburg says we have therefore a biblical source, a Torah source, asrei euthanasia, active medical euthanasia, even for B'nai Noach, let alone for B'nai Yisrael. Therefore, Kevorkian was violating this pasuk as if he really cared when he was basically doing his activities. It's this mucker in the Torah. If anybody asks what the mucker is, it's this pasuk in Parshas Noach that's the source of the Isur of active medical euthanasia. Yes, sir. Quotation F on page number 6. Thank you. Okay, forgive me. Now, the major part of the first section of my shiur now comes to the following point. That you can't actively kill people because of mercy killing is off the table. But what about passive medical euthanasia, which means stopping to treat somebody, stopping the equipment, let nature take its course? Does halacha ever countenance what is called passive medical euthanasia? Think about this for a couple of seconds. I'm not pulling, now pulling the plug on a respirator is active medical euthanasia. So forget about that. But stopping to treat them with chemotherapy, radiotherapy, perhaps even stopping to give them various types of antibiotics, doing other types of activities, even perhaps being monea, artificial hydration, nutrition, can you do that in halacha? I'll get to starting very shortly. But the question is, if a person's on it, which is basically usually the shaylov here, are you allowed to disconnect? Hold off. Now, what I want to point out to you, if you look on page number 6 on top, this is now going to bring us into this heart of this major part of the topic. You have a halach in Simin Shin Lamed Tes on Yeradeya dealing with an individual is called a goses. A goses in English is a moribund patient. Chazal said this person is so deathly ill and is in a death spiral, they automatically are almost going to die, Rav Gos Lemiso, within the next 72 hours. That's how sick they are. So the shayla is, what is the halacha status of a goses? The Mishnah in Semachas, where this Shulchan Aruch is taken from, says that a goses is chay l'chol davar, so he has a din of chiyus. However, they are very, very fragile, to the point that the Mishnah in Semachas, and the Shulchan Aruch quotes this, that even if you close their eyelid, and God forbid, as a result of that little trauma, they might die, harezek k'shefech dam, since you touch the body without a medical reason, and you end up killing the person, you're chayif shvichas dam for having done such. That's how physically tender they are at this point of their life. And Chazal therefore point out, you can only touch their body for medical tipul, for medical reasons, but for non-medical reasons, stay away. Now, the Shulchan Aruch of here quotes a very strange case. I want to give you background on the case because this will bring us into the real heart of the topic. Imagine a Chevra Kadisha in time of Shanim Kadmonios, where we had no refrigeration, and a person was dying in one of them, Midbar Yehuda. The sun was beating down. So the Chevra Kadisha say to themselves, if we're going to wait for this person to die, and first do the Tahara, that sun is going to start causing this body to literally disintegrate. You're going to have a tremendous amount of Nivul HaNes. So as a kavanah v'tayv, what do they say? So they ask the Rav, maybe we should start washing the body when the person's still alive, doing a little tahara on the body when they're still alive. So when they die, we already finished the job, commit them immediately to bury them. So the shayla was asked. The Shulchan Aruch says upon this, even though they have noble kavanos, since you're touching the body for non-medical purposes, any tenuas haguf might be makarav misaso, therefore you're going to be ngarim the misa, hands off, wait until they die, and then you can touch them, not beforehand. So that's number one. Grama samisa with tipulim, even l'shem shemayim, are not going to be permissible. Now, what about the following case? You say to the person who's about to die, do you want to hear a preheat on your hesped? You know, I mean, you're going to have editorial rights. Maybe you want to pick out your oran, make sure halacha, you're happy with it, or maybe pick out your tachrichet. So the Shulchan Aruch says, to do that, you might not be physically causing them grama samisa, but emotionally, psychologically, you're surely causing them to be more broken than they are, and that could also psychologically, emotionally cause them to have a kirev hamisa. So gromis hamisa, even psychologically, besides physiologically, are halachically forbidden by the Torah. That's a given. Yes, sir?
This is only referring to like a sick person who like preceded their death, or let's just say an elderly person who seems healthy right now wants like...
No, we're talking about a person who's an agaisis, a person whose hold is very tender. That's why it's in Sinish and Lama Tess, it's hilkos
geisis. So it's psychological clear reason.
No, we're talking about a person who, they're so close to anything you do that might, could obviously be out of the ordinary, physiologically, psychologically, can cause them to die. But now comes the Ramah, listen very carefully, Ramah makes a comment over here at the end of quotation number 6a, where he says, yeah, all of this stuff I agree, but there's one thing I will allow you to do, and he says that when you're mosa hamaneya, taking away impediments to death is halachically permissible. Hasaras hamaneya, taking away impediments to death. Now think about it for a couple of minutes. I can't be gora misa, but I can take away impediments to death. Now you would think that the Ramah would give us a medical example of this. But what does the Ramah do? He quotes a famous Sefer Chasidim. In those days, they used to believe, well, whether superstition or what, but it was surely supernatural, that when a person is about to die, they need quiet in the backdrop to die. The neshama cannot be misparit menaguf if there's turbulence. So therefore, the quotation quoted by the Sefer Chassidim, which the Ramah quotes, if you have a wood chopper chopping, and he's making a lot of tumult, the person can't die, the neshama won't leave the guf. So what do? You tell the wood chopper, take a couple of dollars, make a lunch break, and I'll stop the chopping. There's manucha in the backdrop, the neshama can be misparit from the guf, and that's an example, hasaras hamaneya muteres. Now, I give you a challenge right now. What is the medical sequel to that? Well, there's no medical sequel to that. So for this reason, interesting enough, when the Ramah said what he said, people heard what he said, but it wasn't defined in the world of medical halacha, what is the practical outcome from this? It wasn't historically, believe it or not, the Ramah lived, approximately speaking, in the middle 1500s. It wasn't until the 1700s that two gedolim of gedolei ha'poskim of that generation had a major argument how you interpret the Ramah. The two sources I'm going to be quoting now is Shelus and Shuvas, Shuvus Yaakov, and the other one is Shelus and Shuvas, Beis Yaakov. They're both like the name Yaakov. They were Balei Machlekes on every issue. They always had arguments. And when it came to this issue of interpretation of the Ramah, they ended up giving two different interpretations, you're going to hear very shortly, that are literally polar opposites in what the Ramah meant. But their machlokus is so crucial that it left an impact on how we paskib his man hazeh. So listen very carefully what they said. You have some... Anything for the board here or no?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Now these two gedolim, listen to what they said. I'm going to start with the Shvus Yaakov, and then we'll get to the Beis Yaakov. The Shvus Yaakov said, as I analyze this Ramah, I say to myself, why did the Ramah give the mashal of stopping the woodchopper from chopping? If he said, it's moot to take away penance and death, I would have said, pashtus, stop medical treatment. In those days, there was no fancy equipment. It meant just stop giving trufas. So why did he use that expression? For me, it's a raya that what the Ramah is simply saying over here is the only thing you're allowed to remove when it comes to removing impediments are dvarim hanisim, which means supernatural phenomena that are keeping the person alive. That you can take away, the Ramah said, but anything that's a dvar shel teva, natural law, medical treatments that normally is given, even though they're not too effective over here, that must be continued to the end. So let me just chart this for you. The Shvus Yaakov therefore says there's a chiyuv of refuah, tivi, natural refuahs, only what he calls refuahs, segulas, are mutter to be removed. He held Allah Hamas, he must continue this medical activity all the way to the end, including the concept of Chilul Shabbos. And therefore, as far as he's concerned, the Ramah only gave a heter to remove supernatural phenomena that are keeping the mess alive. Anything that's based on the normal medical apparatus and activities you do for a person who's dying or sick must be continued until the Nishimah Rebbe. Hold off questions. And that basically the Pesach of the Shvus Yaakov, which meant, as far as he's concerned, there was a chiyuv for refuah all the way to the end. That's his Pesach. The Beis Yaakov said just the opposite. He says, as far as I'm concerned, the mashal he gave from the Sefer Chasidim is the Shena mashal, a nice mashal. But that's not what the Ramah meant. What the Ramah meant is that on a medical level, once a person becomes a goses, which means the medical treatment you're giving that person no longer is effective medically, it's not accomplishing its matara, it's not being merapa the machla, you're only prolonging the agony by preventing the disease from spreading more quickly, but it's not being merab, it's not really curing the underlying disease. As far as he's concerned, at that point in time, there's no longer any mitzvah for refuah. It's asa l'chalal Shabbos for this person. And he therefore held halacha l'masa that stopping treatment is hasaras hamaneh, which the Rama mentioned, and that's the way he passed in halacha l'masa. Now, is this a polar machlokes? This is a major polar machlokes. Mamish mikotzer l'katzer. And depending upon how you paskin over here, you can imagine the ramifications. Now let me go a little further in history over here. This machlokes was in the 1700s. The way we analyze this machlokes in practical halacha, I'm now jumping forward 200 years to the 1900s. The two gedolim that paskined when it came to the Shvus Yaakov's psak are two gedolim that you know very well. The Mishnah Berurah and Simin Shin Chav Tes, possibly like the Shvus Yaakov, which means it must continue to refuah to the end. Chai Ben Voshia Muspehem must go all the way to the end. I don't care, even for Chai Shah, he must go all the way to the end. So therefore, the Shvus Yaakov had over here the Mishnah Berurah passing that way. And also Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, the great Gadol, he also held like the Shvus Yaakov. That's the way you got to go all the way to the end. And believe he was a halakhic medical ethicist. So therefore, you can imagine the impact his psak had, especially on the Haredish community, that you continue everything to the end, even though you're not accomplishing anything, you must go all the way to the end. So therefore, you have him and the Tzitz Eliezer basically speaking, paskening like the Shvus Yaakov. When it comes to the Beis Yaakov, I'm going to give you also two contemporary Gedolim of the 1900s. One is Rav Chaim Dovid HaLevi from Tel Aviv. He paskened like him that there's no longer bits of refuah, and therefore, Meisirin HaTrufah, which you take away the medicines, he even allows you to take away the artificial hydration nutrition, if needed. There's a question, what about removing respiration, a ventilator? There, the psak is, that is grumas amisa. That's too intense to pull away from the cholah. But removing other stuff that you don't have an immediate reaction is not grumas amisa, it's asaras lenea. And halacha mas is permissible. So Rav Chaim Dovid was one person who passed in this way. The other gadol is a gadol who I was very friendly with, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Libus, the very head of the Igud HaRabban in Bezdin in America, one of the Gedolei HaDor when it comes to Psak Halacha. He wrote a sefer called Shelos and Shuvos Beis Avi. He has a very, very big kuntris on medical ethical Shelos. And he paskened also like the Beis Yaakov, same as Chaim Dovid HaLevi. Basically, you stop treating, and they should take this course. Also, no respirator removal, but they therefore paskened like the Beis Yaakov, which means in the 1900s, you had two sets of, these are representative of a lot of other Gedolim, paskening like one like the Shvus Yaakov, one like the Beis Yaakov, coming out with psukim kitzonim. You can imagine two different communities, one way having kind of two different ways of how you handle a patient in the hospital. Hold up one second. I, as a person involved in the field, and most people involved in the field, end up not passing like either of them, we pass them like two other Gedolim. And those who I'm referring to is Rav Moshe Feinstein Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, and Rav Zalman Zecher Tzaddik Livracha. They paid what I call in this topic a Shvil Hazav, a middle derech. And when you hear what they said, you understand what we call them our Gedolei Hadar. Listen to what they said. They point out that when you're treating a person medically, there are two types of medical activities that are taking place simultaneously. On one hand, you're treating the disease, the infection that's killing this person. That's called medical therapeutic care. At the same time, you're also treating the person, maintaining their physical, biological essence, giving them food, giving them drink, even artificially, giving them oxygen if they need that support. Perhaps they might need blood pressure medicine, they might need dialysis, they might need some type of antibiotics because they have a side infection that they get in the hospital. The hospital is the worst place to put a sick person. Because if you didn't have disease exposure anyplace else, in the hospital, there were all different types of bacteria all over. People come in for one disease and they die because of an infection they got in the hospital. So therefore, all of this is called the concept of maintaining the physical, biological essence of the cholah. What these gedolim say is the following. When the Ramah gave the hetter, you're allowed to remove impediments to death. That was dealing with the medical therapeutic care, treating the disease itself. For instance, a person who has end-stage cancer, you're giving them chemotherapy, you're giving them radioactive therapy. In such a case, if you see the care is not killing the cancer, nor really curing the cancer, it's merely stopping it as a dam and preventing it from spreading further quickly, but it's still there, it's not really being merata the machla. In the mind of these gedolim at that point in time, the mitzvah refuah of this type of therapeutic care no longer is halakhically required. The mitzvah refuah is based upon being able to show a result from the refuahs. If it's not showing a result, what kind of mitzvah refuah is it? They, in fact, are using a lumdis that many gedolim pointed out is predicated upon what are the sources you learn the mitzvah refuah from. Is it based upon Rabbi Rafe? Is it based upon the concept of Hashivos or Hashavas Aveda Saguf? If you hold Rabbi Rafe as the source, then if you keep on treating, even if there's no result. If you say it's based upon Hashavas Aveda, that means Hashavas Aveda is only Makuyin if you measure the Aveda. If a medical cure is not curing the disease, so what kind of Hashavas Aveda is this? So therefore, there's no mitzvah to do that type of Hashavas. So therefore, they learned, like the second concept, that unless the medical cure therapeutically is curing the disease, then there's no mitzvah to give it, and you can stop it. Therefore, in that respect, they pass and let the Beis Yaakov, that once a person reaches that level of sickness, that the therapeutic treatments are not helping them whatsoever, it's just prolonging the agony, prolonging the disease's ability to accomplish what it wants to accomplish, the mitzvah Rabbi Rabbi vis-a-vis that phenomenon no longer applies. But when it comes to the concept of maintaining their biological essence, even artificially, hydration, nutrition through nasogastric tubing, or respiration through a ventilator, or giving a person blood pressure medicine, giving a person blood transfusions, dialysis. All of this is biological maintenance, and you're mechuyev to give this until a person passes away. You have to maintain their biological essence to their recovery until they pass away, including pain management, pain medicine. They were very mocked that there's a halakha of Bahakarech Kamok, the Gemara says in Sefer Sanhedrin, even for a person's chayim is bezdin, they used to drug the person up before they killed them, it should be minimize the pain. So the Gebrelim said, there's a chid to do this, a person's chayim is bezdin, the person who's dying in the bed, you should also give them pain management, which we have specialists today, and therefore they make sure that the misa should be as dignified, as mechubedik, as painless as possible. That's called the misa yafta. In their mind, maintaining the biological maintenance of a person, allowing them to have nutrition, hydration, and air to breathe until they pass away, is the menschliche kite. We show to this person our concern for the humanity, and that must be basically continued to the end. So it ends up interesting, if you make the dichotomy, that when it comes to the rabbi medical therapy, they end up, Moshe and Rav Arbach, end up paskening like the Beis Yaakov. It stops when it's no longer functional. When it comes to the concept of maintaining the biological essence, they end like the Shus Yaakov, that must be continued to the end until the person passes away. This is the derech, I would say, by and large, most rabbanim who are involved in the field use as their guideline, as their guidepost. And it's very safe. If you think about it, it makes a great deal of sense in maintaining the covet of this person all the way to the end. I do want to mention to you, halach l'masa, that when it comes to this, there are certain Rashi Tevas you should be familiar with. One of the most famous Rashi Tevas is the DNR, do not resuscitate. And let me explain to you what this is, because unfortunately in the medical world, they play with this term, and people are told to sign documents not knowing what they're signing, and there can be major ramifications. Normally, when a person is dying in hospital, suffering in hospital, and they go into cardiac arrest, the heart and the lungs stop. So legally, the hospital is normally required to call a code, which means that people that are specialists, trained, the person basically undergoes cardiac respiratory arrest, to come to try to bring the person back. Sometimes they succeed, many times they don't succeed. But they put a lot of pressure on this person's body to the point that sometimes using presses to try to make this person to breathe again, they can even break the rib cage. That's how much pressure they put up on this person. The hospital is required to do that if a person expires. However, there's a legal out. And that is the family can sign a document called Do Not Resuscitate and say that if my family member suffers cardiac respiratory arrest, Shevi Yatasa, the hospital should not call a code. The hospital is very anxious and happy for you to do that because they don't want to have the responsibility of later on being sued for malpractice, perhaps for killing the person because they'll be accused of killing them rather than bringing them back to life. They don't want to have that headache. So therefore, they want you to sign a DNR. Now, halacha l'masa, these gadolim I just mentioned, Moshe of Arbach, are of the opinion that when you come towards the end stage of a person's life and the person you see is undergoing each and every day a greater chalishus as a result of the machla, and you're able to track it, you're able to see what's happening over here. Since the ultimate result is going to be a person's going to pass away, and that's the misi affair, they held that you should at that point in time sign the DNR because you do not want them to call a code and violate the Isav Nivel Emes as a result. That's not a misi affair. I mean, if you're allowed to take away the menias of the treatment to allow them to die, it doesn't make sense. Once they've died, you have a chiyuv tachiyus amesim, and it's a tate desasre. Therefore, they held halacha l'masa, a DNR. But the problem is, many times the hospital tells you to sign it earlier than that level. And the problem is, when you sign earlier than that level, what the family is really saying to the hospital is, we already were misyash, we gave up. If the hospital feels the family gave up, they're not going to look what we're doing. They give very shoddy care. Therefore, they don't take care of the patient with the amkus they normally would, because they feel if the family bases on DNR, they're not really that concerned anymore. Therefore, they don't treat the patient with the intensity they really should. And therefore, you cause, because of that, the patient perhaps to die earlier because without proper scrutiny. Therefore, you have to do it at the proper time. That's why you always have to have a rav to be involved in the process. The rav has to be an expert to be able to be involved with the doctors to try to get the feeling we were holding to give them the heter to sign that document. There's no question you have to do that. At the same time you sign a DNR, however, do not sign what's called the DNT. Do not treat. Because by signing that, what you're really saying is that when it comes to biological maintenance, don't do that either. And so for that reason, you have to specify on the form, DNR yes, DNT no, continue biological maintenance to the end, and spell it. Once they have that written, they will not chas v'shalom violate it because they don't want to be sued for malpractice. So this is important to know. There is a famous medical tshuva written in the secular Lancet magazine of England, in which it was shown there were 40 patients that were put in the hospital, 40 in the ICU unit, and 40 in a regular hospital ward, same level of illness, towards the end of life. And ironically, those in the hospital ward live longer than those in the ICU. So the question was, it's counterintuitive. Doesn't make sense. There's so much people in the ICU, they should be living longer. Not if anybody's ever been in a hospital ward, and you press that button, you can press and press, and sometimes press for half an hour, nobody comes. What's going on over here? So the Lancet magazine came to the conclusion. The reason is exactly this point. Because there's so much tipulim taking place in the ICU unit, and I pointed out a person who's a ghost is or toward that and is so what we call susceptible to trauma, the overtaxing of the body by continual blood temperatures and pulse, that manipulation of the body, even though it's being made l'shem shemayim, but since it's unnecessary at that point in time, but it's being done, it ends up traumatizing the body much more. The person ends up dying there quickly than in a hospital ward where they leave the body alone and they should take its course. When Rav Auerbach Zatzal was shown that article, explained to him, he then passed from here, we have a source of makor for halachic hospice. Which means as you come toward the end, if you're able to get him out of that ICU and bring him home and have special nurses that are trained with halachic hospice, which means halachic hospice means you have biological maintenance. In secular hospice, they will not allow you to have, under normal circumstances, biological maintenance. But when it comes to halachic hospice, we have that available. You are therefore allowed to have in your house a little mini situation set up. The family surrounds the person. They watch them continuously, say tefillahs. The Sefer Chassidim, and the Sefer Gadol point out, is the greatest menuchas nefesh a person has when they pass away, is to be surrounded by their beloved ones, saying Tehillim, saying other Dvarim Shel Kedusha. When the neshama leaves the body, saying that, it has a sipuk hanefesh of oneg. We can't even compare what that is. So therefore, halachic hospice is mandated as a misiyof according to the Gedolim. Now, this is all wonderful, important, halachically and hashkafically, but the question is, when does a person die for these tipulim to stop? Before I continue, yes, what's the question?
How does the Beis Yaakov deal with the Chayasha case? Because wouldn't he say that you shouldn't save him?
Now, over there, the person is not dying from a debilitating disease. The person had an accident. And therefore, if that's the case, the halacha lamasa, it's not a question that he's on a disease syndrome. You know exactly what's going on. There's machinery monitoring what's going on. You get hit by a car now. So the fact of the matter is, since you don't know what the medical people will be able to accomplish, in today's society especially, we're able to do things that they weren't able to do many, many years ago in saving people who get crushed under rubble. Therefore, yom ha'chuyiv, this person's not dying, and therefore, to do whatever you can to try to save that person.
So there's definitely a certain level of doubt in Chayasha.
Absolutely, but Sotim Kuf Nefesh is allowed to be done. I also want to make a mention to you is that the Gemara in Masechtas Yoma fits better with the Beis Yaakov than the Shvus Yaakov. Because the Beis Yaakov says, once you come to that level, there's no Chiv of Tipulim, no Yis, no Het of Chol Shabbos. For the Shvus Yaakov, we find the little contradiction. For the Beis Yaakov, you shouldn't have a problem with the Beis Yaakov's Pshat. Because he basically says, you just stop everything, and they should take his course. He's the one who causes the problem, the Beis Yaakov. The Shvus Yaakov, Paskins, you must continue everything to the end.
So that works well.
So for the Shvus Yaakov, it works well. The Beis Yaakov has the problem.
I think, did I not say Beis Yaakov? I meant Beis Yaakov.
The Beis Yaakov is the one you have the problem with, right. Not the Shvus Yaakov. Yes?
So this halacha of ghosties, how we apply this to...
But it's interesting to me, and this is always a plea at Tzuma, a lot of people speak about this, is what we've done is we've taken the din of Goses and made it just more than 72 hours. Unfortunately, the problem is some people make this into months, which they should not be doing. Now, what you have to do is basically, because no doctor is going to swear with a shul d'raisa, this is the minute the person is going to die, because the patient is always full us. And it's up to the Rabbanu Shem to pull the plug off, when we're speaking, so therefore there's no way of knowing. But there are certain disease syndromes and logarithms and certain types of calculations they have based upon studies and statistics that when you come to a certain range, you know what the inevitability is going to be. The only question is a question of days, weeks, hours, what it might be.
When we start applying this, because we say ghost cases only.
The fact of the matter is we usually wait when it comes to this type of stuff, all the way towards the end. If you have a Rav helping supervise, we don't apply these kulis until all the way to the end. Whether it's 3 days before, maybe a week before, because usually the week before is really we start having fake positives and fake negatives. You know, so sometimes you have indications, it's almost immediate, so therefore it's hard to pinpoint this yeast. In fact, some of them don't point out the exactitude of yeast that used to be available in times of Kadmonius. We don't have that exactitude today. So you have to estimate, and therefore we don't just limit it to 72 hours because we don't know what those 72 hours are. So therefore, but to do it months and months before, where it's not indicated, there's no hetter to use this type of stuff. Yes?
So with all this, from what I understand, there's a machlokas about how we define death.
I haven't got to that yet. That's my next part. That's my next topic. Yes?
What if there's like a conflict between their emotional and physical well-being? Like, if you touch them, then maybe like, you know, that'll like stir them and they won't be able to, take it. But also like, not being touched with their family members in their final moments might be like, also might be hard for them.
So what are you asking me, exactly?
So Rav mentioned that like, In the case of ghosts, you're not allowed to touch them because any touch you make might have an adverse effect on their health, but also...
If they say to me, give me your hand, I want to hold on to it, then you give them your hand to hold on to it. You know what I'm saying to you? Because that is giving them the emotional strength. I mean, you know what I'm saying to you? But to say that I'm just going to manipulate your body, whatever it is, without a medical protocol, that's unnecessary. But the person says, hold my hand, I want to show the love, or give me a kiss... Of course you do that. There's no question.
So just like if a doctor would give medical aids, like you'd do whatever he said, just if the patient gives like emotional aids.
So this is a psychological refu. You're giving the person the physical love. There's love. Love, you know, sometimes a person's mental state is as crucial as the physiological state when it comes to a person, you know, thriving or surviving for a little period of time. Question? Okay, let me continue now. Now we're coming to what I would call the second major yisod of today's shiur, and that is a very hot issue. And that is, at what point does a person die the halacha? When do we say Baruch Dayan Emes, when you tear Kriya, and when does the halacha of Chever Kadisha and Kvura come into existence? Now the fact of the matter is, historically, I want you to know this. Historically, the Gadol who sets the tone on what the history was of this for thousands of years is the Chasam Sofer. And the Chasam Sofer says it in his tshuva, on page Rabbi Sai, page number 8, the famous Simon Shin Lamefes, the amount of ink that has been spent on this tshuva is simply mind-boggling. But let me give you a background of the tshuva to understand what the Chasam Sofer was dealing with. One of the famous Talmidim of the Chasam Sofer, and every one of his Talmidim were Gedoy Lehadar, was the Maritz Chiyus. The Maritz Chiyus happened to live in the neighborhood, which is called Mecklenburg, in which at that time, the Duke of Mecklenburg and the people of that part of Germany were very concerned that people were being buried alive. So they made a gezeirah. You shouldn't bury a person till 72 hours after they appear to die. We should make sure the person didn't just faint. Now, they were so concerned that some people used to be buried in coffins where they had like a periscope coming up, like a wind tunnel, an air tunnel above the surface. And there was a rope and a bell that if a person woke up in the coffin, they should ring it, they should basically get the person out of there. That's how worried they were. There are pictures of these types of coffins, as the bell tolls, as they say. Now, so the question is, when they saw how much the goyim were makbid with this pekuach nefesh, so the Maritz Chiyus came running to the Chasam Sofer, Rebbe, do I have to be worried about this? Do I have to also be made on the mace for 72 hours? To which the Chasam Sofer penned this tshuva. And what the Chasam Sofer says, basically is our definition of death dates back to Har Sinai, it could be Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai, it could be based upon the scientific information which were revealed to us at that point in time. But at the end of the tshuva, over here, which is to my mind the most critical part, the summary statement, where I'm pointing my finger, he says, what's considered a person who's dead? He says, Kol she'acha mutal ke'evan domein, when a person is as inanimate as a stone, Ein bo shum defika, there is no circulation, heartbeat taking place. Im achikat batal hanashima, there's no respiration taking place. Ein lano eladivrei teresenu hakadosha shumes, then we have to rely upon our holy Torah that a person's dead. Lo yalino also, you can't keep the body above the ground anymore. Matamelo mkoin loka, if a coin is matami to his high malchus, etc., etc. Which means, according to the Chasam Sofer, there are three simanei misa. no circulation, which means no heartbeat, no respiration, and number three, inanimate as a stone, there doesn't seem to be any muscle movements indicative of any type of residual life in the person's body. They're inanimate as a stone. I don't think he meant necessarily rigor mortis set in yet, but there's no response to any stimulation at that point in time. Now, historically, I want you to know that even the non-Jewish world ultimately accepted this premise. And if you looked in the 1960s in something called the Law Dictionary, that was Black's Law Dictionary, was used by both doctors, lawyers, and other people, legal experts, in defining terms. If you looked what death was, it's irreversible cardiac and respiratory activity. That's the way the non-Jewish world paskin misa to the 1960s, 1970s. However, in the 1960s, 1970s, something happened. And what happened was, is the fact that the world of medicine started to try to attempt to transplant hearts from a donor to a recipient. And they realized that as long as the heart they were getting was coming from a person who died with cardiac respiratory death, that the heart muscles and the tissue was so destroyed by undergoing that type of death, this heart was no longer usable to be used as an implanted heart into somebody else. So they said to themselves, if we're ever going to have heart transplant be successful, we have to redefine death at some earlier point in time. So that was the impetus for the redefinition. It was in order to facilitate transplant. Nobody will argue that's the historical fact. And there were two commissions that were given the job of redefining death. One was a Harvard commission, and the other one was a presidential commission. And on this commission, you had doctors, you had philosophers, you had a whole bunch of the medical ethicists, and they finally came up with what they finally called brain stem death. Now, to understand brain stem death, you have a picture of the brain on page number 9. I'll give you a quick anatomy lesson over here. All of this major brain material over here, which is the cerebrum, is what is enabling you to listen to this shiur today. This little piece called the cerebellum, that's the piece that's going to allow you to walk, pick yourselves up after this year and take a coffee break or go get lunch. That's what the cerebellum does. It gives you balancing capacities to move. This little thing on the bottom over here, looks like a nothing with nothing, is called the brainstem. This is a bigger picture of it. The brainstem, if I have to describe it, really coordinates all the vegetative functions of a human being. It regulates respiration, it regulates body temperature, endocrine control, anything that works automatically in your body that you don't even have to think about. When it comes to biological maintenance, the control center for that is the brainstem. What they said is, if a person has cerebral death or cerebellum death, like Karen Ann Quinlan, that person is still alive. And we're not going to call that person dead. But if we can show the person also has brainstem death, and therefore their control center for vegetative functions that maintain the biological essence of the body has stopped and has died, so what kind of human being is this anymore? They don't have the control center controlling it, because also the respiration center control is with the nerves and everything else that are sensitive to carbon dioxide and oxygen are contained in the medulla of the brain. Therefore, if we can show that this organ is dead, then the person's died. Now, ironically speaking, this is a 20th century halacha. In the time of Chazal, in the time up until the 1900s, this was not a shayla, because normally speaking, if your brain stopped and you stopped respiring, you stopped having cardiac activity, because the respiratory and cardiac systems are connected. So if you, for instance, a person's brain stopped, which means you stop breathing, you stop cardiac activity almost within a couple of minutes from each other. So Bizman HaChazal, whether the respiratory factor or the cardiac factor stopped, you're dead. This is a 1900 shayla, because we had the concept of a respirator. A person's put in a hospital, they're getting sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker, they can't breathe anymore, you put them on a respirator. As they continue on the respirator, the body gets weaker and weaker, and all of a sudden the brain is starting to deteriorate more and more, becomes more dysfunctional. So on one hand, the brain and the brainstem seem to become more and more dysfunctional. Mitzad sheni, the heart from the neck down is chai v'kayam, because the circulatory system and the heart do not need the brain for their control. And therefore, if you look at a brain... hold on. It's not going to tap to you. Don't come to that yet. We'll get to decapitation very shortly. I'm not decapitating this person yet. You know, the head's still connected to the body. So therefore, this specific person in the brainstem death mode, if you look upon him, the surgeons who are neurosurgeons say, they look, they feel, and to the touch, they're more alive than they are dead, because they have the warmth, the temperature of a live human being. If it's only a question of a brain destruction, then you have the kidneys, the liver, the stomach, the heart, everything functioning kapark normal. And the question now is, if I can show the brain stem has died, and therefore it's keeping the person alive on a certain level as the respirator, because it's taking the place of what the lungs would have done, bringing in oxygen, taking out the carbon dioxide, therefore, if you think about it, if I took a person off the respirator, they wouldn't have that access, all the other organs would shut down. So if I'm maintaining this person artificially, and if the machine wasn't there, they would have been dead already. Therefore, since the machine's keeping them alive, they're not really alive anymore. Let's therefore declare the person dead based upon brain death. And as a result of that, take out the beating heart, transplant into a recipient, chai v'kayim, we've saved another life. That was the lumdus behind the President's Commission to try to save life by therefore having death take place earlier. So the question that arose is, what was Halacha's reaction to this? I'm going to get to now your question. And what's interesting and fascinating is there were different approaches. I would say the approach that was approached by 98% of the Gedolim, not being Magzim over here, was to say very simply that according to the Chasam Sofer, there were, in fact, three Simanim. He mentions going back to Har Sinai. And when a person is on the respirator with all the things going on, you only have really one of the Simanim in place, and that is the lack of respiration. The cardiac activity is not predicated mechanically on the respirator. It's going automatically. All the other organs are functioning normally. The person surely not doing kemes. So if that's the case, if you have two of the three still functioning and one not functioning, how, according to the Chasam Sofer, can you call that person dead? That's why I would say up until this day, if you look at a person like Rav Yoshev, he should live and be well, or you look at the other Gedolim who preceded him, Rav Arbach, you look upon, for instance, the Tzitz Eliezer, you look upon the Maharsham, I can go down the list, all of them said exactly what I said to you. Since only one of the three Simanim Misa have taken place, the person is still as alive as we are concerned, and the person can't be declared dead. If you take the heart from this person, you're killing them. This is what these Gedolim said, without a question. Interestingly enough, in the YU community, I would say by and large that Rav Willig and Rav Willig, and besides Rav Willig, we have also, just trying to think now, besides him, you have Rav Willig saying it's Vadai Misa, if you take this person off it. Rav Schechter wants to say it's a Suffolk Misa. Rav Aaron Salvation also said it's Vadai Misa, correct? You have also the opinion of...
not like Rav Yashavar.
According to Rav Yashav, Rav Yashav looked upon this as Vada Misa, Vada Ritzicha. Now, let me ask you a question. Vada Ritzicha. So in all these Gedolim, the question whether it's Vada Ritzicha, Suffolk Ritzicha, but there's some element of Ritzicha, you're not allowed to kill somebody to save somebody else's life, so whether it's Vada Ritzicha, well, Suffolk doesn't really make a difference, Halach L'Masa. But in their mind, since two of the three Simanim is still around, Halach L'Masa, you basically have to give it covet. Now, the other camp, however, said, and there are two versions of this, but what about the following scenario? Now I'm going to come to what you brought up. There's a Mishnah Masechtas Avos that talks about the concept and the yesod of a person who's decapitated. Now the Mishnah says when you take a human being or animal, you decapitate them, they're dead, even if their motions of the muscles taking place, there's locomotion, it's spasms, it's of no halachic significance. And therefore, it's like a lizard's tail to cut off is moving around. There's no halakhic value. In this camp, you had a gadol whose name is Rabbi Tendler, a colleague of mine, who basically said that physical decapitation, nobody questioned, is dead according to halacha. There are cases of people who underwent the guillotine in Europe and France, and after the heads were chopped off, their bodies, headless, used to walk across the stage because there's a certain reflex called the Lazarus reflex that allows the body to move like a chicken can move without a head. So when the executioner saw the dead head body walking towards him, he used to have a heart attack because he thought the guy's coming after him now. So the fact is that the crazy stories like this. But everybody held decapitation, you're dead as dead can be. So Rabbi Tendler says, if physical decapitation is death, I'm going to create a new term. And he initially called it physiological decapitation. Of recent vintage, they start calling it virtual decapitation, but it's the same exact lundus. What's the lundus? If I can prove that even if the head's connected to the body, that the actual control center of the brain is no longer controlling the bottom torso of the body, so what do I care whether it's been physically cut off or physiologically it's no longer being done doing anything to the body below? If it's not controlling anything of the body below, so for all intents and purposes, as if it's been cut off, therefore physiological decapitation should be the same thing as physical decapitation. The person should be declared dead, and therefore he supported brain death, and he still supports it to this very day. That's a shita. There's no question that's a shita. I will tell you there is an alternate approach, but I'll get to that very shortly. I want to first finish logic of Tendler's position. So based upon that, he has, and he's still a major advocate of brain death to this very day, and he's a very big supporter of it. When he brought this information to his shver, Rav Moshe Zacher Tzadik Livracha, in Yomar Mekamos, I'll show you where I'm reading from. If you turn to page number 8 again, there's a tshuva over here. This is a very famous tshuva on this side over here. And in this tshuva, Rav Moshe starts talking once again about what's life and death, a person who's in the hospital, critical care patient, an accident patient. And over here, if you see where my finger is pointing, over here, over here?
The left-hand column.
Yeah. Rav Moshe is now exposed to Rav Tendler's interpretation of brain death with the following statement. Let me read to you the crucial part. He says over here, that when it comes to a person who is an accident patient, who's been brought in quite obviously for a terrible car accident, and all of their rib cage and everything else has basically been squashed, they can't breathe properly. So what they usually do when it comes to such a person is they put him on a respirator immediately. So Rav Moshe then says, a person's under the respirator, this trauma patient, his body might once again start to spread out and function properly. He says, and even though, but it's also talking about a patient, doesn't seem to be anything else indicating any type of life. He's talking about what's called radioisotope testing, where you put basically an isotope in the blood, and you have machinery monitoring the blood flow from here to up here, and it's able to, based upon the radioisotope, whether or not the blood is perfusing the brain or not. So if you're able to show there's no longer any blood flow going to the brain, now the cells of the brain are incredibly sensitive. If they're deprived of momentary lack of oxygen, they start to disintegrate almost immediately and start to liquefy. It's called the lysis of the brain. I haven't got to the nose yet. We're going to get to the nose. That's the other sheet that we're going to get to very shortly. We're now dealing with brain death. We can only do one death at a time. Now, I want to first go through his shita. So therefore, he told Rav Moshe, listen very carefully. He says, if I can show there's no longer any ability for the moach to have any type of shayachus laguf, the brain is no longer connected to the body, the brain is totally disintegrated and literally liquefied, that's considered decapitation. Rav Moshe put in two provisions to accept physiological decapitations, and this is very important. All the brain cells have deteriorated, and number two, she'ain hamoach shayach l'guf klal, there's no control management from the brain to the lower torso of the body. If that's the metzius, that I would equate to physical decapitation. Now, the reason this is Ruach HaKodesh, because Rav Moshe was just told this, he wasn't the medical scientist over, he was told information and he passed in this way, is because when brain death was initially analyzed and articulated by the President's Commission, the Harvard Commission, based upon science's knowledge then, they were of the opinion that when a person reaches brainstem death, that's exactly the biological reality. that the brain no longer controls anything going on in the lower part of the body. That's what they really felt. They might not have felt that every cell in the brain has died, but that there's no shaykh between the brain and the rest of the body is surely they thought that way. Many years later on, many of the major learning centers, including the Harvard Medical School, had a reevaluation of brain death. And now the shock came to the fore. They realized after how many thousands of people they diagnosed with brain death, upon which they then did postmortems and analysis, that they realized these people, even though they've been declared brain dead according to the criteria, that the bottom of the brain is still controlling certain things they never thought it was at that point in time, namely the hypothalamus gland, the pituitary gland, which means there's control of endocrine function taking place, there's body temperature taking place, there's other types of activities taking place in the bottom torso of the body, which can only be regulated by the brainstem and such. They then started stroking their beards if they had any, or started pulling out the hair if they had any left, realizing that they can no longer medically say that a brainstem person's brain is no longer involved with the rest of the body as a control center. And therefore they were mavata, we can no longer have that as the definition. Now, if they were intellectually honest, they would say, well, if that's the case, since the person is still being controlled by the brain, the brain's not really dead, we should throw out brainstem interpretation. Mm-hmm. But as one of the philosophers who was part of the President's Commission, I once heard, many years later on, he called a session, a public session, to do some catharsis, to basically be building the mezvah that he was wrong in his philosophical understanding of the problem. And he wanted now to tell people, philosophically, he could no longer justify brain death. In his problem, he wanted to justify brain death by the fact the person is still alive, by being kept alive by the machine, the respirator. So if that's the case, what's keeping you alive is a machine, not your body, so you're a corpse, you're dead. He then realized he can't justify that. Because if that's the truth, anybody who has a pacemaker in the body, or has a defibrillator that's put in to keep your heart pacing properly, and if your heart stops to dysfunction, it shocks you and puts it back on, according to that, if you need a machine to keep you alive, you have a lot of walking corpses around in the universe. So he therefore said, I can no longer say if a person has to have machinery to help them regulate all the other body functions that are working by themselves, I can no longer call that person a dead person, because if I did, I would have to change the interpretation, and nobody's going to say that. So for this reason, he took away his philosophical justification. So when people asked him, well, are you now going to renege on the brain death interpretation? No, no, that we can't do. Why? Because medicine needs it. We have to justify taking out the heart earlier to justify heart transplants. So even though my svara has been destroyed, once keep in shahuta huter, and let's go weiter. The fact of the matter is, nobody in the medical world today who's honest will tell you that the brain itself is no longer connected to the body. This has been demonstrated over and over again. In the report that I'm leaving with Rabbi David, you'll hear the documentation. The first 30 pages of this is medical information culled by the greatest doctors in the world on this topic, giving medical information of exactly what I just told you concerning the fact that nobody at this point in time is going to say that the brain is not still functioning. But it's not, but in fact, one wanted to say that the hypothalamus gland, which is always part of the medulla, if it's functioning, it's not part of the brain. We're now going to call it outside the brain, which some of the doctors said is now redefining anatomy of the person's body. And that's part of the brainstem. They tried to take away the stiva. That's not part of the brain. That's something else, you know, outside the brain. The fact of the matter is that's the metzius. And I will tell you this: when Rav Auerbach Zatzal heard what the Harvard criteria finally later on, how they fought, they used to tell him, "Ein bo shayach zeh l'guf klal," like Rav Moshe was told. When Rav Auerbach heard the facts that that's not the case, he was so full of animosity, rigza. They were mishakit to me. They told me a lie. That he, at that point in time, said, they wasted all my hours trying to work and see whether or not we can accept halachic brain death, because he was willing to accept it if all the cells of the brain are dead, which is an impossibility. So he wanted to also have near kavla gamri. But that's not a possibility. We know for a fact, based upon postmortems, that most of the cells of the brain, not all of them, are near kavla gamri, not on the level he's talking about. So it's not a medical metzius. But when he heard that the brain is still connecting and doing some stuff below, he basically tossed it out. There's nothing more to talk about. There were very, very misleading sukkim of Rav Auerbach going back and forth. In this document, you have the record of what happened historically, why he changed his mind momentarily, and then he brought it back to the way he passed it finally. No, But at the end of the day, the fact that the medical community is switching back and forth what the brain is doing, not doing, had a major play in this. That's why at the end of the day, even though those who still accept brain death as physiological adaptation have gone, they're still continuing with that. Mostly Gedolim, who obviously had the problems with the medical community's restatement, therefore could not accept that as the interpretation. Now we come into the other camp of brain death. There's one other Mahalakim brain death based upon the Gemara in Masechtas Yoma, and that is the one that's articulated by Dr. Abraham Steinberg that was later accepted by the Rabbanis HaRoshes in Eretz Israel. All the Rabbanim, I want to tell you the following. And listen to me carefully, because every time I read this report, I start to cry, but I'm going to tell you right now that when you read the report, you will see that most of the Gedolim Paskin, the Rabbanis HaRoshes, predicated their medical opinion on the way Dr. Abraham Steinberg discussed the medicine with them. They also predicated their opinion on the fact that Rav Tendler said that Rav Moshe Feinstein accepted brain death. With those two suppositions, that Rav Tendler claims Rav Moshe accepted it, which is not true, and the fact that the Rabbanis HaRoshes relied upon the medicine being described to them, they came to various medical decisions, halachic decisions, but the fact of the matter is that when our committee was able to interview some that were still alive, like Nechemia Goldberg, she'll live and be well, and others, and they told us that initially they were told that Ein Bo Shayach Sem Aguf Klal, and that when he was later told by people Sheyesh Bo Shayach Sem Aguf Klal, Rav Nechemia Goldberg, who was one of the signatories of Rabbanis HaRoshes' heter, no longer gave the heter for brain death. It's interesting. He told people to sign the donor cards, but the donor card he never so has either use Mrs. Mochi and Mrs. Halev for definition. He told people when it comes to that, I'm not telling you to check off Mrs. Mochi anymore. You should sign the donor card, you know, to advocate people should give organs. But with a vados, a brain death was initially muskum amongst all of them. When he heard certain things that weren't told him then, he basically, ironically, on a certain level, backtracked and did not want to paskin brain death anymore.
Is there a written statement of his rejection? Rav Zalman Nechemia?
You'll see, and over here, you'll see discussions with him, and the three episodes it records that later on he did things and paskin certain ways, showing he did not accept brain death anymore. It's documented in this over here. You'll see it very carefully. But the fact of the matter is, all of these Gedolim said they're not scientists. They relied upon the medicine given to them and the facts. Now their Mahalach, which you mentioned very beautifully, is on page number 7. It's based upon a Gemara in Masechtas Yoma, a very famous Gemara. The Gemara talks about that same Nebuch, the same fellow caught under the rubble on Shabbos with the collapsed building. Hatzolah comes to the location, and you see feet sticking out of the rubble. Now, the person can still be alive. I mean, we just had various types of tragedies all over the world where people were excavated and they were still alive. So Hatzolah asks the Shaykh, what should we do? So the Gemara has a machlekes, when it comes, you excavate until you come to a definitive knowledge, the person is dead. The suffix of nefesh is derech Shabbos. So one sheet is, you excavate up to the heart area. If you can't feel any type of muscle movements of any heartbeat, you declare the person dead. The other sheet is, no, you have to excavate up into the nose, you do the feather test, and if the feather test doesn't show any air coming in and out, that shows the person stopped breathing. Now guess what, Chevra? Whether the person stopped cardiac or breathing, one thing is for sure, the other one stopped as well. Because you can't have heartbeat without respiration. You can't have respiration without heartbeat unless you have a ventilator, and then have a ventilator at the time of the Gemara. So whichever one stopped, that was an automatic indicator the other one stopped as well. So the question is, what does the Gemara mean? Is the machlokis whether the Iker Chiyus is belayv? Or the Ikechiyas B'Neshima, is that the Machlokes? This Dr. Abraham Steinberg felt that was the case, and therefore he wanted a Paskin. And since later on the Gemara mentions when it comes to life, Kol Asher Nishmas Ruach Chaim B'Apav, that the Ikeh was comes out of the nose, not that the nose, but obviously is the Aver of Chiyas, but the nose means respiration is taking place, or there's lack of respiration, and that could also indicate that the brainstem of the brain that controls the respiration is likewise dysfunctional by the fact the person is no longer breathing, which is a medical fact Chazal didn't have any knowledge at the time the Gemara was written. This is only something we found out within the last 40 years. But the fact of the matter is, the halach is it neshima the ikar or the cardiac the ikar? Since the Shulchan Aruch Paskin, as we go according to the neshima, that under all circumstances, you have to go to the neshima. He therefore paskined, and he caused other gedolim to paskin this way as well, that the ikar is spontaneous respiration. We don't pass in the life, the Iker is the Neshima, and that's how respiratory death became accepted. The Rabbanus Rosh is passing respiratory death, not the physical decapitation death. The feather test is a proof that the respiration stopped. And this is how that shita came into existence. Also, there's a philosophical machlokes. Is the neshama, is the Mishkan neshama b'moach, or is the Mishkan ha-neshama b'lev? Very famous machlokes. That also depends upon which shita you accept. Now, the problem with this approach is that when you read the Gemara, it sounds good, but it doesn't sound good if you read Rashi. And it surely doesn't sound good if you read the way that the Chacham Tzvi interpreted Rashi, which everybody was makubal, and the way ultimately the Chassam Sofer interpreted the sugya. Because if you look very carefully in Rashi, on page number 7, Rashi has a change of girsa. If you look where it says, quotation B, ad heichen ubodek, ad chotmo, yesh omrim ad libo, that's one pshat. If you look in Rashi, Hochi Garsinen, see this? Also, I want to show you something else. At the end of the Gemara, Gemara says, quotation, Gemara Papa Machlokis Mimata Lamal, you find the person's feet first, Alva Mamalu Lamat, you find the person's head first, came in the Badak Leva Chotmo, as soon as you check the nose, Shuvein Itzarech, you don't have to be Badak Gemara, Dixiv Kolashin Ismukhaim Bapa, it seems, the Iker is the respiration. So Rashi says on Dibra Masva, Hochi Garsinen, quotation G, Machlokis Dahanech Tanoi, the Ma'ama Ad Libo, Uma'ama ad chotm. If you notice, Rashi has a different gears than the Gemara. Our Gemara has that the chotm is first and Libo is afterwards. He says the gears should be one said ad libo, ma'ama ad chotmo, milmatu lamaila. If you find feet first, shemozi derech magalosov tachila ubodik v'holach klapi rosho, the ma'ama belibo yesh lahavchin im yesh bo chius she nishmaso dofekeshav. Rashi learns the ikar is in fact the cardiac function. And what Rashi is saying is, what's the machlokes of libo or ad chotem? In the time of the Gemara, they didn't have stethoscopes. So there was no way when they found a person in the rubble that they can peer into the body with the type of device we have today to see if there's any type of intimation. There's no EKG machine. You couldn't check. So the only way they were able to figure out whether the heart's still beating or moving is by touching this traumatized area. If a person, Kanayin Ahava, was meaty like me, as the Chakhan Tzvi says, it's possible that they were not able to perceive a beating heart because of all the blubber and all the other stuff, you know, above the surface. And without the special device we have today, there's no way of detecting that. So al tachumre b'kach nefesh, if you check the lathe, if he is believed, you should declare the person dead, but maybe it's too weak. So what do? We creep up further to the nose, because the nose is the only aperture the body has that's an opening into the body. There you can know what's going on. If a person's breathing and there's cardiac and there's therefore respiratory activity, the lungs are going in and out, there has to be cardiac activity because he can't have respiration without cardiac activity. So you go up to the nose, if you're still breathing as faintly as it might be, that indicates not only the lungs are still chayvei kayam, it means the cardiac is still chayvei kayam. So the way the Chacham Tzvi learns this Rashi, and most of them learn this Rashi is, the ikachias is belave, the chumra to be baidek, the nose, is the chumra to make sure that 100% the heart's no longer functioning. Because if I can show the feather test shows zero air coming out of the nose, not only the lungs stop, but definitely the heart stop. Because without a respirator, there's no division between them. That's what Rashi says. And the Chacham Tzvi in your Ma'ariv HaKamos, I'll show you where it is, you can learn it by yourself inside, says this explicitly. This Chacham Tzvi over here says this explicitly. Ikachi is belev. The Teres Kabbalah, that's the Mishkan HaNefesh, that's his story now, that the Shammah resides in the circulatory system, Ki HaNefesh Ubedamu. Therefore, if that's the case, in his mind, the Chumrah is a Chumrah in cardiac death, not respiratory death, and that's the way the Chacham Tzvi passed, and that's why the Chassam Sofer said, you have to have no Neshima, no cardiac activity, Daimuk Evan, which means the body means it's totally dysfunctional. That's where it comes from this reading of the Gemara, which means spontaneous respiration is not exclusively the concern. Now these people over here, especially Steinberg, forget Leib is never mentioned in the Gemara. I mean, who's Gier saying it? He ruled out Rashi. He reads the Gemara without Rashi here whatsoever. He points out that in some Gemara, the Talmud Yerushalmi has Tavur, which is the navel rather than the Leib. But it doesn't make a difference, because at the end of the day, the navel, we have the diaphragm, which really controls a lot of the stuff when it comes to breathing, controls other stuff over here. So if you can see movement over here, it means there's other movement taking place. But Beinkach on Beinkach, that's why the Chasam Sofer mentions the Leib, and that's why all the Gedolim I mentioned before. In their mind, the pashas of the sugya is cardiac and respiratory activity. They want to say it's only respiratory activity, so this is an alternate to that of Rabbi Tenner. It's called respiratory death, not brain death. What they salvage by this is all the problems you have with the comparison between physical decapitation and physiological not being on all fours. What's your question?
I'm just wondering what we have now, like nowadays. We have, you know, respirators. We have machines that are breathing for the person. So technically, if they have cardiac death, then
if a person suffers cardiac death, you will see it because there's a flat line.
Right.
So the person's dead.
But the respirator is going to keep.
Because the respirator is a machine. The machine's not measuring the body. The machine's doing its work.
Right.
So once a person has a flat line on the heart, you pull the plug. The person's dead. Because
right.
that's not respiration from the body. That's artificial. Like a person, like a pacemaker stops. The pacemaker stops.
Right.
So therefore, that's halachically insignificant.
Right.
But when the body didn't have any of this, and the body was relying upon its own kochos, each one of these positions, each one of these areas was crucial and definitive. That's what the Chasam Sofer mentions, the three Simani Misa. The fact of the matter is 98% of the poskim learn the Gemara this way. In this document, you'll see how the Rabbanus HaRashis learned about 5-6 Gedolim, whose names are mentioned. Each one has their chidushim, but they talked about, even Bizman HaGemara, respiration without cardiac activity and vice versa, as a mitzius, which biologically is not a mitzius. So they talk about mitzius in the world of medicine, nobody would even contemplate. So Benkach go Benkach, when you look at the whole sugya, you walk away with a feeling over here, a sense that it's either a vadai, the person is still alive, and therefore taking an organ will be vadai ritzicha. It might be a suffek if the person is alive, so it's a suffek ritzicha, but nobody will give for the sake of Pekach Nefesh the ability for you to kill somebody for this, even with Chayasha, for the sake of Pekach Nefesh of a person in front of you. Nobody's going to give you that heter. The secular world will give you that heter. I will tell you now, there is a discipline in the secular world where they take a person who's not a brain dead patient, but is deathly ill, and what they do is they take him off the respirator for the heart to stop. His heart stopped, he's dead. And then they cut out the heart and they put it to somebody else. That's a discipline now in the secular world. That's Ritzicha Shein Kamala. But this is what's called the slippery slope. That once you start this heter, even if you apply all the testing that Rabbi Tenner wants you to do, one of the major things this report will show you is that a study was done around the world concerning the procedures and brain death interpretation in the secular medical world. Nobody does the procedures the way that Rabbi Tenner and everybody else wanted them to do. They do what's good for them, and therefore, I would say the majority of people who are being diagnosed with brain death around the world today, could very well be, are not even halakhically brain death, according to those who hold that shita, and they're being killed because nobody has the ability to supervise, and it's being done only because of the hospital's need for organs, and the family's wishes to do a good deed, not realizing they're authorizing their person to be killed.
There's a worldwide organization, both here and in America, promoting signing of donor cards. So what exactly should be the proper response to that?
Okay, so let me just say the following. I know the organization you're referring to because I've spoken with them, I've debated for them, and I've fought with them. Let me say the following.
And a lot of Rabbanim who have signed that.
I know. What's the name? H-O-D. H-O-D-S. Now, the fact of the matter is, there's a certain section over here in this paper you'll be able to read as well, dealing with the halachic response to being donors of organs, period. You know, whether or not we accept basically the premise of the Nodi Yehuda, who held that you're allowed to perform nivlames for the sake of kuch nefesh of the adam lefaneinu, therefore you're allowed to even violate the isav nivlames for the sake of giving somebody an organ, which later on is the way it was developed in halachic literature. So the question over here is, which organs? Now, to do a post-mortem on a kidney where you use halachic death of respiratory cardiac, if you're using that, so doing a kidney transplant is no problem, doing a skin transplant is no problem, corneas are no problem. So those are areas you can use the classical interpretation of death. When it comes to transplanting a heart or lungs, there only if you hold from brain death or respiratory death can you really be a donor. If you hold from cardiac respiratory death, at this point in time you cannot be a donor because you're really killing yourself for the sake of saving somebody else's life. So therefore that's a problem. The HAD claims recently, they don't tell people that you have to be a cardiac lung. I said if you want to hold like the brain, like the cardiac respiratory camp Gesunde Height, you can designate it on the card. So in their mind, they're covering all bases. If you want to hold like the brain death interpretation, so you check off that on the card. I told you before, Rabbi Nechemia Goldberg also does the same thing. Sign the card, and you just sign which halacha camp you're basically. But the fact is, it's predicated upon the Sfarah, that in fact, there is a mitzvah to give an organ posthumously when it comes to Pekuach Nefesh. Now, some Gedolim said there's a mitzvah. Other Gedolim are of the opinion that they say very simply, Kasha Odemes Nasan Chavshim in a mitzvah, how can be a chiv upon you to do something that you're not chayv to do, period, myriad. So some say, based upon that, there might be a kima mitzvah, Pekuach Nefesh. But they say there's a chiv mitzvah on the Gavra, who are we giving the chiv to? So if that's the case, it's you know, it's meritorious to do such. Emotion, one of his tshuvas basically indicates this. But nevertheless, halacha lemasa, there's no question there is an inyan. Whether to sign the card or not is a good question. Now, I will tell you, in some places in America, to sign that card, what you'd be subjecting yourself is to have your body used even for anatomical dissection of medical students to learn medicine, which surely is prohibited by most of the chazal when it comes to this. It's not a pekuach nefesh lefaneinu. So signing it for specifically donors, there's a big debate. Some say you should, some say you don't. Those of us who signed quite obviously felt there's a need to sign. You can't decry them because there are gedolim who paskin that way. But you can't give your heart and lungs if you don't hold less brain death or spontaneous respiration death. If you hold the other one, there's no way of doing it at this point in time. Yes?
If you're a doctor, should you refuse to do these operations?
So let me give you a very important protocol. Any of you going into medicine, so let me just tell you something important to know. Listen to me very carefully. This is important. I always fasten this. In the world of medicine today, we have all different types of groups of people from different religious backgrounds. They're Christians, they're Muslims, they're Jews, etc., etc. Every religion has their restrictions, what you're allowed to do. There is a protocol in the hospital world where the hospitals know that if they want good doctors, they have to respect these people's religious preferences. Therefore, if a doctor is told to do something which they say will compromise their religious rights, the hospital cannot force them to do it. They can hand over the case to somebody else. There can't be any legal penalties placed against this person because you're allowed, because of religious reasons, to refrain from doing this type of activity. Thank God the Christians are there and the Muslims. We, b'schusam, can also say religiously on Jewish law we can't do this, and there's nothing on the face of the hospital can do to cause any kanas for you to be negatively impacted upon. That exists not only in learning medicine, but in the practice of medicine. Do another therapeutic abortion.
Right.
I can say I don't want to do it. Yeah.
The Christians don't accept brainstem death. The world accepts it.
The world,
the medical establishment.
Yeah, absolutely, they accept it.
Right.
When it comes to the Christian world, it depends who you ask and who even knows this. I'll be honest with you. I have found that over the years, dealing with Christian theologians and Christian medical ethicists, if you want to know where they get the information, I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to end with this story, but this story will indicate something to you that I want you to think about. Many, many years ago, I was asked to lecture in a hospital to a hospital staff, to the doctors and nurses, giving them the protocols of what they should be sensitive to when it comes to dealing with Jewish patients. So on the panel, I discussed for clients what the Jews expect. There was a Catholic priest discussing what the Catholic world expects. There was a Muslim cleric. There was a Protestant cleric. There was a Seventh-day Adventist. And there were the Yashka witnesses. Everybody made a presentation. And, you know, what's interesting is, you know, I made my medical presentation. The Christian made his. Well, some things are mutter, some things are usser. The Muslim, by them, everything's usser. The Protestants, by them, everything's mutter. And when it came to the Seventh-day Adventist, he's still trying to figure out what day of the week seventh day is. And when it came to the Yashka witnesses, he started to hand out his literature to convert people to the audience. That's what he was busy doing. He was handing out his literature, you know, to try to convert everybody to him. So after we had the first part of the lecture series, the Yashka witness came over to me and said to me, "Rabbi, I'm very impressed with you, with your presentation. I'm going to have a private discussion with you." I said, "Ooh, what's a discussion with me?" So we went into a private room. Now, if you know the witnesses, they have money to spend like anything. And they are Madison Avenue in PR on the highest level. They come with business suits. They come with an attaché case of the finest leather. Even the folders is the mehudr shemahadr shemahadrin. Everything has to be le'elam u'le'elam. She says to me, "I want you to know something, Rabbi. I'll tell you something, but I'm not going to say this publicly. I'll always claim I never said this, but I have to say it. In Christianity, which I represent, our form of Christianity, we don't have too many sources that discuss medicine and law and religion. And it's a sad situation, but you guys, you Jews, have incredible amounts of sources. You're full of sources. You interpret the Bible in ways that are amazing. It's simply amazing. And therefore, most of my medical knowledge, and when it comes to medical ethics, well, most of my Christian colleagues, we're taking Jewish sources and we're just recycling them as a way of giving our Christian. But without you guys, we wouldn't have the ability to even say Ki Hu Zeh. But I want to give you a treat this morning. I want to show you the most important document that I value as my periodical that I read continuously on a weekly basis. From there, I derive the incredible wonders of Jewish law and medicine, and without it, I would be lost. You want to see it? I said, "Sure, show it to me." So he goes into his valise, he pulls out this gigantic file, you know, and he lays it in front of me, "Rabbi, this is it." And I'm looking to myself, and nobody showed me. His major source he reads every week, religiously, is the Jewish press. This is the major Jewish vehicle of medical ethics. I don't know who's reading, nobody's reading over there. But the fact is, this is my major source. And he takes this very seriously. I then wrote a little note to Rabbi Klassi afterwards, "The watchtower are your Hasidim." Just remember that. You know, but the fact of the matter is, and this is true, I've spoken to many of the Catholic Galachim. They clandestinely take courses in JTS or other places because in their religion they don't have too much source material. They don't. It's everything that comes from us. So if they're machmir, they're grabbing it from us. If they're makel, they couldn't care the least what we're saying because their religion doesn't care what we're saying. So therefore, it doesn't make a difference. So the fact of the matter is, what I want you to get from all of this is Ashrein Matov Chalkeinu, that the Rebbeinu Shem gave us this Torah and gave us sensitivities and understandings. And now, in the world of halacha, I don't think there is any part of halacha that you have more shelos and shuvos and halachos and psukos and debates and halachic analysis than medical halacha. And you look at all areas of halacha, this is the most intense of all the discussions. Chazal realized this is mamash kihem chayenu or chimenu, this was crucial. That's why many gedolim, not only were gedolim when it came to Torah, the gedolim medicine, because they felt the achrayus that this should be in the hands of people who know what life and death is all about and have a sensitivity to chiyus. The Rambam felt that achrayus. Many gedolim also felt that achrayus. What I want to, I'm not saying you all have to become doctors here. Even though I will tell you, Rav David Lifshitz, who was one of the great Rosh Hashivas in YU, used to say, in my time, you know, Adi became a Rav, we became a doctor, when we were going to school. So Rav David Lifshitz, who was, you know, one of the great developers in Europe, so he used to go into an elevator in YU, and he used to go around to ask the boys, "What are you going to become a doc? What are you going to become when you go from YU?" So 90% of the people in the elevator used to say, "We're becoming doctors." Maybe one said they'll become a Rav, a Rosh Hashiva, an economist. So W used to turn to the doctors and say the following. He says, "I don't understand." He says, "Now I understand that, you know, now you need doctors to take care of people, to cure people from diseases. Wonderful, sir. But when the Mashiach comes, and the Mashiach is going to cure all diseases, everyone's going to be healthy, you're going to be out of panasa. It's better," he says, "to come a Rosh Hashiva and a Rav, so at that time, you'll find plenty of panasa." Ah, Rabbi Murray.
Thank you so much for coming, and let me see if anyone followed my advice. I see a few people followed my advice, but they didn't know where to find you people last year. oh my gosh, this is a Bronx reunion.
We all are Bronxes, that's what you don't realize.
They understand.
He was my Rebbe. In my first year of high school.
Long before you were born, 1960.
This man put me on my feet. Because thank you very much for inviting us. Baruch Hashem, Yishbi Matzliya from Mitzvah Hashem.
I'm trying to get back to normalcy. If you would see what was waiting for me, the emails, it was better not. This new book, Open Doors, it's unbelievable.
You told me, wonderful.
Hit home, yeah, but you don't even start to realize what's happened.
Baruch Hashem.
Since I spoke with you, I told Tova Lichtenstein this book last night, from Berbaya Levine, Fader Nachas, Dachman Habim Kayach.
That's right, absolutely. Mirz Hashem.
Gentlemen, in this topic, he's one of the great rabbanim in the world, and I just went through, some of you know, the last 2 months. Every day we had to make decisions of end-of-life decisions.
I'm leaving you a copy. He's going to give you a copy of this.
Okay, Yashikaya. Right. I can only tell you, l'chvod the hospitals, because there was such bad publicity of the hospital in Tel Aviv with a prominent family. I can only tell you, and my brother's a medical doctor. I'm an MR in medicine. In learning, I know a little bit, but not in medicine. And my sister-in-law is a nurse. And we were blown away by the care in Shaarei Tzedek. And in Herzog. Herzog is more of a hospice where my mother was. But I can give you one example in Shaarei Tzedek where my brother left instructions not to do something, not to do. And they pleaded with me, call your brother. My brother's teaching, he teaches in a medical school. He said, call your brother. We will feel bad if we don't do it. You hear the Lashon?
Wow.
And I called my brother, if they'll feel bad, go ahead, let them do it. And we're talking a lady of 98. They didn't treat her 98. They treated her like she was 18. We were, and no one knew us. It's not that we came in and it's Dr. Rook. Of course, my brother lived in the center of the country until recently, and he practiced in Tel Shomer and Laniato. So, and they certainly didn't know me because I'm not in the medical profession. So I just want you to be aware. I spoke about this in class in a different context. That among the miracles of Israel, we've achieved a higher level of general medical practice for everyone than Canada. You know, in Canada, an 82-year-old man had to go to court. They had to go to court to get treatment for him. Then England, and look what Obama wanted him to do, socialized medicine. Among my friends, they curse him every day, morning and night. I curse him for this. But they curse him for that.
It's on top.
I just want to...
Zayge Bench, Rabbi Zah. Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay.
So, as I was saying, what was I saying? Remind me of that. So what I was pointing out to you is that the fact of the matter is, I know what I was saying, is that halacha lamasa, I would say very simply, is that this year should inspire you to what you're doing, to your learning, to your sensitivities. We have a teres achayim over here that deals with every facet of our life from the time we get up in the morning to the time we go to sleep at night. And the fact that Chazal was so concerned, and the Torah is so concerned, and the Rabbi Nishlam so concerned, as the Rambam says, Chai v'loshim musbehem, Torah is chesed v'rachim ba'ulam. We look upon Torah as a form of chesed and rachim, and love, divine compassion and love. And I wish each and every one of you hatzlach and bracha, whatever you're planning to do in your life. All of you have a mission. Hashem should give you the ability to find yourself and do what Hashem gave you as your tzav in this world. The ikar is, whatever you do should be a kiddush shem shemayim for yourself, for Klal Yisrael at large. The whole world, in the last couple of weeks, it's interesting, the whole world just looks what we do as Jews. When a Jew spits on another Jew, that is more news than people being killed in Syria. It's amazing to me. You have 5,000 people killed in Syria, but nobody talks about that. But the second state of America comes and she starts giving musa to the Jews, women can't sit next to men in the buses. That's bothering her tremendously. We're living in an oil of vulbal over here. It's a crazy world. But what that shows you, as the Panavid Rosh, one of the Panavid Rosh just wrote a little musa shmuz, like I just saw it on the internet. He says, whatever happens into the world, when the Jews are basically are accused of something, it could be a simim and Hashem's giving us a musa shmuz to reflect upon ourselves, and maybe there's something we've done that maybe might, you know, Hashem trying to give us a wake-up call to scrutinize and to be careful. At the end of the day, we got to bring Avas Yisrael to the highest level. And over here, from what I see happening beneath the surface over here, in the last couple of weeks I've been in Eretz Israel firsthand, there is some upheaval between the Chilonim and the Datiim, unnecessary sinneschen, but it's there. It's there. Yesterday I happened to be in the Jewish Agency, and I met with some of the heads of the Jewish Agency. And you know, when I started, you know, hacking me a chaynik about, you know, the Charedim, so I said, what about the secularists? They're equally guilty, because on both sides they're trying to provoke one another. You know, my children live in Beitar Elite. They made Aliyah. So the mayor at Beitar Elite, when he saw this happening, said that when the secularists come on the bus to provoke you, offer them chocolate milk and cake and say Baruchim Habo'im. You know? Don't with people trying to on a political level maneuver. What we have to do is Klal Yisrael cause a Kiddush Shem Shemayim. And even what we think spitting on somebody, the Chil Hashem that caused around the world is simply mind-boggling. I never saw it, but it's Min HaShemayim, it's a simen. We just did Aser HaBetavis. Chazal says Aser HaBetavis could be because of the Chet Mechias Yosef, which is Sin HaSchina. So if that's the case, we got to do tshuva over here. Therefore, we have to be Mekadosh Shem Shem Barabim. I know the Hashkafa that Rav David teaches you, that Rabbi Rav Kefa teaches you, that this Moshe teaches you is Mamish Avistron Ein Kamo. That's the Torah I was brought up with from my Chinuch. That's what we got to do. We got to show people that even we have different opinions in Halacha. All the Gedolim I mentioned today, believe me, I have nothing personally against them. The fact of the matter is, I want to end with this, is that Rav Auerbach said in one of his places, the interpretation of death is so crucial that in his own mind, he feels it could be we need the Sanhedrin HaGadol to come and machriya whether or not we should even accept brain death as an alternate, because you're dealing with a major, major new definition of life and death. You're not talking about something that, you know, like a little minimal psak halach. You're talking about a major, major institution. There aren't any makaris, really, definitively for brain death the way it ideally should be.
I heard from Professor Norman Katz in St. Louis.
Yeah, what did he say?
He was a Talmud of the Rav in the 40s. He retired the Methodist professor at Washington University. He asked the Rav about this topic.
Yeah.
The Rav said, this issue will only be able to be determined by Eliyahu HaNavi. Tishbi Yitaris Kushas HaNavi. What the definition of that?
Yeah. I mean, the Rav, I also saw yesterday, it's in this kutris, that the Rav said to one of the Talmidim, even the Vilna Gaon could not paskin l'sheila. He says, you need mamish, you're talking about something that's only beruma sheila. So for that reason, I am not coming chas v'shalom to disparage anybody's opinion, elo ve'elo, as far as we're concerned, everybody's entitled to their opinion. And until the Bezin HaGadol paskins one another way, that's the halacha, elo ve'elo v'chem chayim. But I came here not to disparage, on the contrary, to be mavara with the different shittas are, for you to understand what the shittas are. When it comes to the euthanasia shayla, that's pretty much, you know, I would say makubo, what the final psak is, even though you will find extremists on all levels when it comes to that. But there's a, when it comes to brain death, it's the most lively discussion you find in halacha to this very day. Dvarim omdibirim sha'olam, realize that we're dealing over here with a question of taking a life to save another life. And therefore, that's why everybody is so concerned about that phenomenon. And that's why everybody gets, you know, unnerved. And, you know, they start really, you know, start to have a tremendous machlokes, a little shem shemayim. So don't take it in a negative way. I mean, I have tremendous kavod for the gedolim that I debate with, Rav Tendler, and all the other people that I discuss this with. They are entitled to their opinion. But I have to give you factually what the different shittas are, what the different gedolim that postmen have to say about this. There has to be the concept of kavod chachamim when it comes to halachic intercourse. It has to be done in a bekavodic way. When I debated Rabbi Tel on the topic, there was tremendous kavod chachamim. We both spoke b'derech kavod, and we addressed the issues back and forth, you know, to be mazal with the different shittas. That's what I want you to walk away with today. Nobody's being mazal with anybody's kavod. Please remember that and realize that this is going to be available for you, chevre. If you have a further interest, please make copies for the chevre to see. When you read this, it's not going to be one reading, Rabbi. This is like a 100-page paper. That's like a 1,000-page novel. It's very intense, but you'll now appreciate it based upon the Hagdama I gave today. This is like a Hagdama Shia. If we learn the Sugya, this is what this is all about. If you follow up and you read this, then you'll have incredible knowledge in this, on this area, on an area you never saw before, that really in-depth. Yes, sir?
What's the general psak that we accept now? Is there one?
For what?
For this whole brain death?
For the brain, so I said to you, if you take a head count, if you forgive me the pun, you take a head count. So most of the Gedolim happen to either B'Teres Vada, B'Teres Sofek, don't allow it. There are, the Rabbanus of Rosh did paskin the kula, you have to say that. Rabbi Tevel surely paskin the kula, you cannot deny that. So you can't say that there aren't people out there who hold the kula. But I'm telling you, if you did for a head count of Hadio Achareb and Lahatais, and the Sanhedrin had a head count today, you would see which way they're heading. It could be when Eliyahu comes or the Bezna Gadol comes, they might have different opinions. The medicine might have changed by that. I will tell you one thing, Rabbi Isai. What I do see happening, and this is a different shir entirely, maybe next time we want to talk about it, the answer to all of these problems is not going to be in trying to have more physical transplants from people's bodies taking place, because there'll never be enough organs to take care of everybody's needs. The ultimate lumdis is before I precise Hashem curing everybody's sickness, is that in stem cell research, which Eretz Yisrael now is the leading authority in the world, they have created stem cells of cardiac, which literally can be reinserted into the body from your own body, from somatic cells. These cells, which have your own DNA, which can be made into cardiac cells, can then replace your sick cardiac cells, heal the heart itself from its own body structure without having to bring a foreign body in. There'll be no need to have any type of immunosuppressive drugs to prevent rejection, which everybody who gets a heart has to live the rest of their life on immunosuppressant drugs, otherwise your body rejects the foreign body. If you're able to take a stem cell from your body, which can be made in a laboratory, and Technion is the leading expert in the world in doing this. In fact, in America today, you can't do a procedure of stem cell transplants in America. FDA didn't approve it. So what doctors are doing now is they're taking the materials from people's bodies, sending it to the Technion Eretz Yisrael. In the laboratories, they make the cardiac stem cells, send it back to the doctors in America. The doctor then takes the patient outside of continental America, one of the islands over there, does the procedure, brings them back, and some people have been spared the need of a cardiac transplant by using their own cells. So that's a new pshat of a leif chadash Hashem he's going to give us. I always say, when you use somebody else's heart, that's not a leif chadash. But when you have your own heart recycled by your own body material, this is the leif chadash, a new pshat in the Navi. That's what's going to really change the whole mode of the whole discussion over here. If you're able to recreate your heart with your own body cells being reestablished, rebuilt in the laboratory, that's going to basically ameliorate a lot of these problems. Rabbi Yisai, there's much more to talk about. That could be one wonderful audience. Hatzlach and bracha. And thank you, my dear colleague, my chavah Nechman, for inviting me to speak to the Talmidim today.